Welcome to the Onyx Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Dixie Cochran, here with Eddie Webb.
Hello.
And Matthew Dawkins.
Hello.
So I'm excited about today's topic, because today we are going to be taking a deep dive into Beckett's Jihad Diary, as well as various aspects of Vampire the Masquerade and Metaplot. Of course, Matthew Dawkins, a lot of you know him as the Gentleman Gamer. He is our Vampire Metaplot expert. And
That's very kind.
I've seen your videos. You can just talk for like 30 minutes without a script about some of this stuff. It's ridiculous. I don't know how you do it. You know more about Vampire the Masquerade than I know about the English language, and I have a degree in it. So, yeah.
Can you get a degree in Vampire the Masquerade?
No, I mean, you should be able to.
If you can, I think that I would award an honorary one to Matthew at this point. And of course, Eddie, you've been working on the property for quite a while as well.
Yes.
So, when did you start with Vampire the Masquerade? Just to give our audience kind of an idea of everybody's expertise.
Oh, that's fair. I actually started kind of late. I sort of started working on it when I was working on the World Arts MMO, which was going to be based on Vampire the Masquerade, but I didn't really work on the property proper until 2011 when I was Justin Achille asked me to help him out with Vampire 20th Anniversary Edition.
Okay, so see, and I thought you had worked on it longer than that, so now I know as well. But coming in on V20, I mean, that's a big project to come in on too, so that's awesome that you got to work on that.
It was very exciting.
A lot of reworking.
Well, and that was an interesting thing. It was a lot of what could we tweak, what could we keep. So some interesting discussions about it. And I had been a fan of Vampire the Masquerade since the 90s. But yeah, I mean, in terms of me actually getting my hands dirty and working on it, it's actually only been about 7 years.
Okay. And Matthew, I know that you've also been playing Vampire for years and years, but what was your first actual Masquerade project?
Ooh, which was my first project? I think V20 True Black Hand, the Book of the Talmahera, which is how you're supposed to pronounce it, was my first writing project for Vampire the Masquerade.
Awesome. And of course you went on to be one of the co-developers of Beckett's Jihad Diary, which is the main book we're talking about today. So for those people who don't know, Matthew, do you want to describe what Beckett's Jihad Diary is? I know you've done videos on this. I'm actually holding my copy right now to give this podcast some veracity.
I should hold my copy as well. You know, we can commune via diaries.
Right. Or if you were here, I could just smack you with it if you want to interrupt me. You know, it's pretty heavy.
So the Beckett's Jihad Diary is one part, or I guess nine parts artifact book, one part chronicle hooks. It's a book that spans the gamut of metaplot throughout Vampire the Masquerade, and basically has a chapter that is assigned to each of the main metaplot beats from Vampire the Masquerade's long and coloured history, ranging all the way back from the early 90s. It has something in it from every single source book that has ever existed, and I don't mean we have repurposed the material and just copied and pasted it. I mean, if there was a character in Milwaukee by Night, that character has appeared in this book. If there was an artifact in Diablerie Britain, that artifact has appeared in this book. But it isn't in a ramshackle mishmash way. It's all assembled into a complete narrative that sometimes jumps here and there to make our protagonist Beckett tour the world of darkness. He's literally touring the world, interviewing various vampires of legend and notoriety, exploring more and more about what the jihad is, the eternal struggle between Methuselahs and neonates, finding out the secrets of Camarilla, Bloodline, Sabbat, various influential sires, princes, and the like. And he's going from everywhere from Washington, D.C., to Haiti, to Macau, and everywhere in between, in order to find out the truth of what Kindred Society is all about. Is it all just one big game where Methuselahs and Antediluvians are pulling the strings? Is the game set up by the neonates themselves, who feel they have to fight in an eternal war? And you go everywhere, from the origins of Clan Tremere, the many faces of Sorlot, through to the fall of the Giovanni. Fall to the Giovanni? Oh, no. Fall of the Cappadocians. The Giovanni haven't fallen. Sorry to the very few fans who love the Giovanni. I love the Giovanni, to be fair, but they haven't fallen yet. the fact is, and this is an interesting thing, I guess, to lead on to, for me, is Beckett's Jihad Diary is the complete book of Metaplot. And while a lot of people are going to look at that and think, this is daunting, it is deliberately presented in a way that can be accessed, incorporated into your games, and whatnot. But it's also a capstone for V20. It's the capstone for an anniversary, a celebration of the previous 20, 25 years of Vampire the Masquerade, and sets up for the newest edition, V5.
Right.
To both tie up some metaplot ends and also expand others. And taking a concept like the Giovanni, for instance, they have been on a hugely colourful journey since their introduction. And you get to see where they have reached in these modern nights in Beckett's Jihad Diary, along with every other clan, sect, and notorious vampire.
Right. I mean, that's what's so great about this book, is that you can read it almost just like it's a novel, if you want to, if you just want to read it and learn about things. Or you can read it to get plot hooks for your vampire games, either for V5 or V20 games, if you want, which I think is super awesome. Like, it really is an awesome, like, bridge product. So Eddie, I was talking to Neil Price yesterday, who is actually the other co-developer on this book, and told him we were going to be recording this, and asked him if he had any anecdotes. And one of the things that he said was that this book was starting to have a very different tone in the beginning, related to Beckett's Ghoul, and that it was getting a little bit silly. And also that it went through a few different iterations of, like, is this going to be just a V20 book? Is this going to lead into, you know, 5th edition? What's this going to do? So I was wondering if you could speak to the process a little bit and the tone of the book.
Certainly. This was, like, a book I actually had pitched before the acquisition of the new White Wolf, of the original property from CCP. So it had been in mind for a while. When I brought Neil on board, and we probably talk about that a little bit, is unlike traditional co-developers where two developers working simultaneously, Neil came on first, and then we transitioned to Matthew as part of that process. So it was kind of more of a serialized thing. But during the initial design, we got the writers on board, we got an email list together, and Neil and I generally like to have fun when we're developing and we're working on projects. So
yeah, of course.
A lot of the writers were having fun with Beckett's relationship with Cesar, his ghoul. And so they would post a little stuff online. And then Neil and I separately were kind of like making kind of like, you know, Cesar fanfic references or, you know, making jokes at the expense of the dynamic. And it was actually a good learning experience because what happened in the first draft was a lot of writers took that as a cue of, oh, we should make this a funny book. And when you have a bunch of writers each putting one or two funny bits into their material, you end up with a lot of funny material, and that's just not the tone we were going for. And that was something where Neil and I separately went, oh, we should be careful about that. And so Neil and I had a chat about that, and we were able to kind of go back to the writers and say, okay, a couple of jokes, you know, because Beckett does have a dry sense of humor, is fine. But this is just way too much. And what we were seeing was almost a Blackadder-esque relationship between where Cesar was kind of the butt of the joke a lot of times. And it's like, no, he should be cool too. Just because he's a ghoul, and just because Beckett treats him like crap, doesn't mean that the character is crap.
Right, exactly. I mean, yeah, Beckett as a character, and we'll get into him in one second, is very much known for being sarcastic and dry, but he's also serious about what he cares about and about the work he's doing. I think balancing that and making it a little too silly would have been fun to read in a very different way. But I also would have been like, is this a World of Darkness book?
Exactly, and that's kind of what happened. Although, interestingly, when we first started working with the writers on this, we were, because this is all written kind of from Beckett's perspective, we were trying to figure out a way to get the writers on the same page in terms of what Beckett's voice is, in terms of his writing voice.
Right.
And so we actually just decided to get some voice clips from the Bloodlines video game and use those.
Yeah, totally.
We thought that was kind of the most iconic and detailed version of Beckett. And we also pulled some of the Klein novels and some of the references, but that was one we had the most sustained amount of Beckett talking that we could find. So actually it's interesting that the Bloodlines video game ended up kind of in some way inspiring and giving some impact into how Beckett's Jihad Diary played out.
Just to go on a brief tangent, I almost feel like Bloodlines is the new wrestling reference, because we talk about Bloodlines in like every podcast at some point. It's really weird.
Let's make it the new wrestling reference. That joke was getting old anyway.
Okay, so we are now committed to bringing Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines in every podcast episode. Which
whenever seems natural.
True, but it often does seem more natural than bringing up wrestling, I guess.
And
anyway,
it's also one that you have
tangent.
More input on, too. You'll be able to actually bring up more Bloodlines references.
True,
too.
I can talk about it. So, Matthew, to what I was saying a second ago, tell our audience, who is Beckett and why does he have a jihad diary? And what does that mean? Because the word jihad, I know, for some people is like a weird word to be using.
Well, as I wrote for the back cover text, jihad is a loaded term, especially in today's society. And just as it is in today's society, so it should be in tonight's society for the kindred. Obviously, to us, jihad means holy war. In vampire terms, jihad means the eternal struggle. And the eternal struggle is the constant pitting of vampire against vampire, dating back not just to the War of Princes in the Dark Ages, but all the way back to Rome and Carthage and all the conflicts beforehand. The idea being that vampires are never free from the bloodlines that create them. And that means if you are a 12th generation Ventru, you are still ultimately beholden to a 4th generation or 3rd generation, the Ventru, who is steering your every fate and destiny. So the jihad is either, depending on your perspective, the fight to break free from that control, or the realization that it exists, or knowing that you are a pawn in someone else's chess game. That's what the jihad is. That's why the card game was called Jihad. That was the Vampire the Masquerade card game before it was turned into the Eternal Struggle. And that's what it is for Beckett's Jihad Diary. It is his accounting of the various manipulations and plottings that are taking place across the world. Now, as for who Beckett is, I guess there's two answers there. The in-universe answer is he is likely a Gangrel who was embraced in 17th century England, around the time of the English Civil War. And he is an antiquarian, come archaeologist, and a bit of a snoop as well, and gossip monger. And he likes to go to all the places where big, important things are happening. He likes to record them, account them, get in the faces of the people behind them, ask them why they're doing what they're doing, and generally get to the bottom of, I guess, kindred psychology, sociology, and society, why it works the way it does. He wants to know the truth behind vampires' origins and potentially their Gehenna. What will happen to them in the future? Is Gehenna a certainty? That kind of thing. Now, the out-of-universe answer is that Beckett is a cipher for the reader, because he never receives stats, although I have no doubt that in some book one day he probably will. Beckett isn't a statted character. We haven't given him a definitive sire or origin, or indeed clan. So he has the same level of probably maturity and dark humour and approach to a lot of the subject matter in Vampire the Masquerade that a lot of the readers and role players do.
Right.
Because he is that sort of, I guess, everyman vampire in that respect.
Right. So Eddie, when you pitched that, is that why it was Beckett from the beginning? Was just because he is a good character with reason to be all over the place any given time? Because he really gets around in this book.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of the point. Initially, I wasn't actually sure we were going to have a single viewpoint character. When I first pitched the idea, it was just Jihad Diary. And originally, I envisioned it a bit more like things like Bukhanan or the RCA's fragments, where it's like there's lots of different writers all contributing to one common book. But pretty quickly, I think it was Rich Thomas actually that was like, you know, why don't we just use Beckett because he's a perfect character for this exploration, and having one viewpoint character didn't make a ton of sense. The other kind of piece of it is Beckett is uniquely suited to being the outsider. Any other character, in there's very few completely independent characters in Vampire the Masquerade. All of them are either Camarilla, Spot, or Anarchs, which means naturally you're going to get a skewed perspective. And so right. having a character that actually stands outside of those and can comment on them was hugely valuable for just from a production standpoint. But of course, again, like I mentioned, the challenge was getting all the writers on the same page because they all had one viewpoint character to work from, which is something we frankly have never done before. So it was an interesting
point. True. Yeah, I mean, aside from some of the like clan novels and things back in the day, it's very rare that a vampire book has one main character or any viewpoint characters at all. Usually we're writing about these characters from more of a textbook perspective.
Mm-hmm.
It's not super common that we have one character who's acting as the narrator or as the lens through which we're seeing the world. And Beckett's an interesting one for that because he can be a little unreliable. Like, he's not...
Yes.
He's not, you know, committed to bringing the truth to us. He is committed to interpreting things however he interprets them. And so...
That's the reason why I wanted to have a character of some kind was that unreliability, because vampires lie. And so by allowing a character to talk about things rather than, like you say, a textbook talking about these things, when we do that in the traditional sense, there's the implication in what's being written said is true. Because the book, the designers are telling you this is how the world works. Whereas if a character's telling you how the world works, if you as a storyteller want to use a chapter from Jihad Diary as a prop, you could say, well, Beckett's lying about this part, and you could just change it for your chronicle.
Yeah, or just that he was mistaken about that part.
Right.
Because, you know, Beckett can be wrong. He is not an infallible character.
He won't believe that, but that is true.
Oh, yeah, Beckett probably thinks he's an infallible character.
Yeah, there are definitely moments throughout the book where, let's say, he's interviewing a vampire or trying to mediate peace negotiations between a couple of vampires, and he's the person that inflames the situation. He doesn't get answers, he just makes it more difficult to actually find out what the truth is. So... Beckett is I guess our chaos agent as well as our roving reporter, because a lot of the hell that's going on in Beckett's Jihad Diary can pretty much be put down to Beckett being a little intrusive into the quiet plots of other vampires.
Right. Yeah. No. I mean, he shows up and messes with people sometimes and then leaves. You're kind of like, what did you accomplish there, yeah. sir?
And then Cesar going again.
Well, this is one of the few books that has all three of our names in the front, too, which is part of why we wanted to talk about it, was mm-hmm. because, you know, Matthew is one of the developers and wrote on it, and Eddie did additional writing according to the credits. Not sure what that means, but you got a special line.
Yeah. Well, actually,
and then I edited it, so.
Well, actually, that's actually kind of funny is in the back of Beckett's, there's a section about breaking down the different editions of Vampire and how to slant yes. the chronicle and different things. That actually came from my outline for the Endless Ages anthology.
Oh.
Because for Endless Ages, I had to tell authors who may not be steeped in the nuances between different vampire editions, here's how we need to slant each of those stories. And I ended up showing it to Neil because we're talking about that. And Neil's like, can I just use this? And I'm like, sure. So he rewrote it slightly. From the outline, so that's why I have this weird additional writing credit, because I did do the writing, but it wasn't for this book specifically.
And that text ends up in the Storyteller's Vault Guide for Vampire the Masquerade Writers.
Right.
Which I wrote, because yes. I've never had an original idea in my life.
Which I did not get a credit on, so there you go.
Well, I mean, if I edited it for this book, I also didn't get a credit on it, so it's okay, Eddie. We can just be uncredited storytellers, vault authors. It's okay.
Q-Q.
I'm just going to go cry about it later.
I'll become a gestalt credit, that's all.
All right, so a lot of this book centers around Beckett looking for another book called The Book of the Grey Boar. Mm-hmm. Do either of you want to speak to that? Like, what his quest is all about, as far as that goes? Why it's so important?
Well, the Book of the Grave War is a relatively minor artifact in the great reams of Vampire the Masquerade history. It's no Book of Nod, but I believe it's introduced all the way back in Diablerie Britain, I think.
Really?
And then may get another mention in Milwaukee by Night, and that's it. I don't think it's mentioned anywhere else. But, in fact, I'm fairly certain it's Diablerie Britain because the Malkavian... The Tremere scholar who is analysing the Book of the Grave War is Dr. Mortius, who then ends up in Milwaukee by Night. But I digress. Book of the Grave War is a little bit of a MacGuffin to destroy anyone's illusions. It's a way of getting Beckett onto the track of an artifact that can potentially break blood bonds, mm-hmm. sever allegiance to clans, and generally cause all kinds of merry hell, because it was written by a very powerful Malkavian who could potentially implant his clan's innate madness in the text of a book. This is something that isn't brand new to Vampire. It's existed in various other fictional narrative where there's an artifact that's so strong that it can break your mind by reading it. And to go in the role-playing world, something that comes to mind is the Cirinishad, which is a Forgotten Realms artifact penned by the god Cirik, where when you read it, you can't accept any god other than Cirik in your head. And when I was writing the Book of the Grave War stuff for Beckett's Jihad Diary, mm-hmm. that is basically the same idea behind this, that once you've read it, depending on who you are, it might put you on the path to Golconda, it may well break your blood bonds to your clan, as it does to Karna, one of our titular Tremere within this book. Or it could perform any other function. And this is going to sound appalling. I can't recall now whether Beckett ever gets his hands on the original in the book. I don't think he does. Because Karna makes off with it. But there's various copies floating around that have various lesser effects as well. Now, going back to its origins in Diablerie Britain, it's supposed to talk about the jihad, and it's supposed to talk about the strength of Methuselahs and how to break away from them, but that's about all we get told. So some of its text gets adapted for this new book, Beckett's Jihad Diary. We add some for it as well, and you never know, one day we might actually see an artifact book for the Book of the Grave War itself.
That could be fun, but I will say that if it's an artifact book that looks anything like this one, our art director will kill us.
Yes, yeah, Mike will kill us and everyone we care about.
Yes.
So for those of you that haven't seen Beckett's Jihad Diary, the layout of it definitely, it reminds me a little bit of the Requiem First Edition clan books, where there's just artifacts and, you know, photographs and little things and various handwritings just paper clipped all over the place, and transcripts and portraits, and it's a gorgeous book just in the design of it. The art notes were really extensive because a lot of them were still in the document when I edited it, so I remember seeing a whole bunch of like, this needs to be paper clipped on top of this, and this needs to look like this, and this is in so-and-so's handwriting. Which, yeah, it's gorgeous, but it's a lot of work for our layout team.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, Mike can blame me a lot for that, which, you know, I'll accept that. In a weird way, and you hate to peak too young in a career, early, but for me, Beckett's Jihad Diary is like the mountaintop of the type of book that I am good at developing. because my mind may not always be perfect for systems, or it may not necessarily gel with a certain world or a certain certain genre. But this kind of artifact book with incredibly detailed art notes, layouts, and so on, I can visualize it exactly in my mind. And so when I start writing out these great reams of art notes and styles and so on for Mike, it's just coming straight from my head, hammering it out. And so a lot of the chapters in that book, when I wrote them, they really are just me writing on a tear, and I could get some of those chapters written, multiple chapters in one night, and then I'd go back and revise them, of course.
Right.
But that's because this subject matter and this particular book really spoke to me as a writer as well as a developer. I could just apply that immediately, and so then Mike gets to see the semi-finished result and think, what the hell am I going to do with all these notes, because now I've got to apply paper clips to this, staples to that, put that in this person's handwriting. So the point, it probably would have been very helpful for me to do some kind of lexicon to say, okay, so this if I make this code, it means this person's handwriting and so on. But no, every single art note was written out in full, no annotations or time saving at all on this one.
Yeah.
Good job. Not saving time.
Oh. My pleasure.
So I know that this book is, you know, packed full of plot hooks. We call it the Matthew Dawkins rule at this point in outlines, that every sentence should have a plot hook. But it's also packed full of Easter eggs for anybody that's been playing Vampire the Masquerade for years, that's familiar with the meta plot. What are some of... Eddie or Matthew, what are your favorite Easter eggs or characters that you brought back that people probably wouldn't expect to see in a book in, 2018?
I'll let Eddie go first.
Okay. We'll let Eddie talk first.
Damn, I was worried about that. So here's kind of a peek behind the curtain. I'm not great at the meta plot for Vampire the Masquerade. That's actually one of the reasons why I wanted to get a good development team on that, is because things like Matthew's mentioned about where the Book of the Rave War came from, I had no clue, because that wasn't what I was focused on as line developer. My focus was making sure that the whole thing kind of holds together. But that said, the stuff that I really loved was less, here's this cool Easter egg reference to a specific book, and more the tonal references to large swaths of things. Like the fact that people can read this book and go, yes, these are absolutely the characters I remember from 15, 20 years ago, is right. Actually really hard to do. And I'm very, very glad about that. The fact that Beckett's relationship with Cesar, Beckett's relationship with Lucida as well, the fact that we're able to communicate those relationships that previously had entire, stories and novels dedicated to them, and people could get those in short form and go, yes, that's actually correct, and while also people who never read that material can still get what's happening there. I was really pleased at how well the writers and developers managed to thread the needle between not alienating people who aren't steeped in this lore, but the people who are can come in and go, this absolutely tonally feels exactly the characters I haven't read in a very long time.
Right, yeah. When I was editing it, like, I don't have an encyclopedic knowledge of vampire metaplot either. That's really mostly a Matthew Dawkins kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I looked up a lot of stuff when I was editing, because I was wanting to make sure that names were spelled right and places were spelled right and this, that, and the other. Which is a lot of what I do when I'm editing a book like this that takes place all over the world, is go like, oh, is that, city name and Haiti spelled correctly? Let me make sure, Mm-hmm. And so much of what I found, was on the Vampire the Masquerade Wikipedia, sites and all that, just trying to, and the references that would kind of be like, oh, yeah, this was referenced in one book in 1996. And I'd be like, really? And they brought it back for this? That's amazing. Yeah. And, I'm a big fan of Lucida, as most people probably know if they listen to me talk about my sweet baby, Lissandra. And so, yeah, seeing her, this is really cool. My favorite, before I pass it off to Matthew, because I'm sure he can talk forever, about this kind of subject, because he put, you know, between you and Neil, you put so much in this. That's just little references and cool things. I'm just going to make my second Bloodlines reference and say that I was excited to see both Damsel and Smiling Jack. mm-hmm. Because it's characters I'm very familiar with. And to see them in the book and not just in the game was really cool, obviously.
Wasn't the Arcane Sarcophagus name drop too?
Yes. Yes, it did. Okay. It's not called Unkarn Sarcophagus. Well, it's a different sarcophagus, and there are a lot of suggestions in the back as to what could possibly be in it.
Right.
Yes, Matthew? Are you going to correct
so
us?
So here's a... Well, here's a peek behind the curtain for the listeners. So Smiling Jack was an easy one. We could put him in because he had already appeared in L.A. by Night, and I think he was in Clambuck Bruja Revised as well.
Yeah, he's been all over.
But characters like Therese, Jeanette, Damsel, Mitnick, I think, Rodriguez from the video game weren't characters we could just put in the book, because the truth is, with licensing, those characters are creations of Activision and are still creations of Activision.
Mm-hmm.
And so any references to material that appears in Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines had to be subtle.
Yes.
And with, you know, whilst being reverential as well, we weren't just trying to sneak one by Activision, but we wanted to reward fans. And I think that's the key here, and the reason the Easter egg idea is so successful in Beckett's Jihad Diary. It's, well, I love connectivity in books. I love that idea that readers can read a chapter and, like Eddie said, they can think back to a book they read 15 years before and they can go, oh yeah, I recognize that character, I recognize that event, because it rewards the reader for being diligent. It makes the reader feel clever, without trying to sound patronizing. It does. It creates a sense of well-being within the reader, because they think, oh, I get it. And whether you do that within one book or whether you do it in a book like this that is a capstone to 20-odd years of previous books, either one works. And one of the most fantastic things for me is when readers, and a lot of them have said this, have come to me and said, what I really love about Beckett's Jihad Diary is I have to keep putting it down and going back to the White Wolf wiki, or going back to my library of Vampire the Masquerade books and seeing whether I can identify what's going on before I get to the end of it, and see whether I can recognize who this character is or remember them. And that for me is a brilliant feeling, because that's exactly what Neil and I were intending with this. We want people to read it and to maybe do a little bit of research, treat it like a mystery novel almost, because you might know what's coming based on the characters you've read about in the past, but if you're brand new to it, it's a fresh mystery and you can still enjoy it, or you can look on the White Wolf wiki for spoilers.
Right.
And in terms of your original question, I guess, mm-hmm. my favourite Easter eggs are probably... Well, I guess the most obscure ones... So here's a couple that I don't think anyone has mentioned yet on any forum or post that I've seen. There's a bunch of artifacts in this book and references to Wankler's Bank that are only in Vampire the Eternal Struggle. Wankler's, in particular, name, as stupid as it sounds, is only... in the art for a Vampire the Eternal Struggle card that I can't even remember which card it is, but in the art it depicts a skyscraper with a with Wankler's written across the top of it in red sort of neon writing with the L knocked out.
Didn't you post that recently by somewhere?
I posted that one. Now, the other one, there's like the Sharl fragment. That's a Harbingers of Skulls specific card for Vampire the Eternal Struggle. That fragment gets translated in Beckett's Jihad Diary. It's mentioned nowhere else. But one of the more fun ones is a loop back, a tie back to Law of the Clans, which is a relatively recent book. And that's... has an awful lot to do with the Malkavians and the Fibonacci number sequence.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And I don't think anyone's pointed this out yet, so I'm going to point it out now and spoil it. But in the Madness of Jerusalem chapter, when Beckett is basically delving into the pit that contains Malkav, potentially,
right.
or Malachi, or whatever is down there. Each of the timestamps on his audio transcript, it ends up being the Fibonacci sequence of numbers, because I just thought that would be fun to put in. And that's the kind of geekery you're dealing with. it just pours out of me verbal effluvia and ends up on the page like this.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely did not catch that, and I have read this closer than most people. So,
well done.
I love stuff like that, though. I think that's cool. And of course, now everybody that listens to this will know, and they can hold it over their friends who don't listen to the podcast. And,
right.
Exactly.
Talk about how great everything is and how good they are at reading things. So, be like, I found this all by myself. Look at this cool Easter egg I found, right? You can just... So it was funny earlier you mentioned back cover text and that you wrote something for it. And I of course, like a silly person, turned over my deluxe copy, which does not have back cover text. I was kind of like, oh, I don't actually know what the back cover text says. I think I probably have it in a Word file somewhere. But yeah, so Matthew, so since you came on about halfway through this project and took over as developer, how was that transition? Was there anything that changed where your vision and Neil's didn't quite align, or did you guys mesh really well? Because I know that he did a lot of research for this book and put a whole lot of work into it at the front end, and then you kind of came in and, you know, ran it home, so.
Oh, yeah, Neil and Eddie... but especially Neil, sorry Eddie, really sure. built the foundations for this book, did fantastic work, and set up a brilliant team of writers, set them on their way. At that stage, my only part as a, I guess, developer, well, I was a writer from the beginning.
Right, right, right.
But Neil and I had lots of chats about what the chapters should focus on, so which books in particular should we revisit and which ones should we maybe bypass. And so that's where we decided the first chapter should be Milwaukee by Night again, and then leading almost immediately onto Chicago by Night, and looking at Transylvania Chronicles, Giovanni Chronicles, things like that. Neil and I decided that very early on, but that was just when I was a writer. When I took over the development role, and I never wholly took over, it was always a team effort between Neil and myself.
Okay.
It was to take on some of the redlining process,
mm-hmm.
to redirect some of the writers that had really sort of gone off-piste with the way they were writing the book. And this sometimes happens on a big collaborative effort like Beckett's Jihad Diary. You've got a lot of chapters, a lot of different voice, and you mentioned about Beckett's voice having to be consistent throughout. There's a lot of characters that reappear throughout this book,
mm-hmm.
as well as writing styles, document styles that we needed to be consistent throughout. And so managing those writers to ensure that they were all honing in on the style we wanted was something I had to do. But then it came to the stretch goals that we managed to achieve via Kickstarter, and I developed those pretty much from scratch, and that allowed Neil to come on as a writer. So we kind of flip-flopped from beginning to end. Neil wrote the Way of... No, he didn't write The Way of Three Eyes. I wrote that. How did he allow me to write a chapter?
Yeah, how did he allow...
And that was my automatic instinct. He wrote a chapter on Carthage.
I cannot imagine Neil letting anybody else write Salubri.
I don't know how that happened. He was probably deeply invested in Scion, or I just didn't tell him I was doing it. No, I would never be that.
Why not?
But we got to the end of the project, and we had... There was never really any conflict. I think at first the biggest cause of disagreement was based around whether we should have a central thread going through it or whether it should be individual chapters just almost disassociated from each other. And also it was the aforementioned humour that exists within this book.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't mind admitting, I hated the very camp farcical banter between Beckett and Cesar, and then Beckett and Vikos, and But we came to compromise on that. We agreed on some things, disagreed on others. And by the end of it, I was happy. I think Neil was happy. I'm fairly sure he was happy with what we ended up with. Because there's a scene with Beckett and Vikos in... Where are they? In... Now, you know, it's a damn shame when I can't remember something vampire-related. They are in a mansion belonging to a very elusive vampire that I'm not going to name because he is deliberately elusive. And Vikos has been brought there from Istanbul after potentially encountering the... again, I'm going to leave this mysterious, but if you like Constantinople by Night and the Dark Ages Clan novel series, you'll know it's something to do with the Drakon. And there's almost sexual tension between Beckett and Vikos.
Yes, I love that.
Yeah, these centuries-old nemeses. Mm-hmm. Because they're both archaeologists in their own way. They both want to seek the truth behind their respective situations. But at the same time, they have incredibly different methods, or would like to think that they do. I think the character that is sharing the scene with them basically suggests that they just have sex and get it over with.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, and it's like, you should just go get that out of your system.
Yeah, and there's not exactly subtext, but there's the sort of omitted line of where they're both pretty much considering it. You know, there's a pause where they're thinking, you know, this isn't such an insane idea, or... My God, this guy's right. This is what we've been building up to all along. And I like that. I like that level of subtlety.
Oh, yeah.
And in some parts of the book that we were more egregious at first.
Yes.
And I deliberately made efforts to tone some of that down while keeping other parts of it quite open. And I think it worked out for the best.
I remember, yeah, I think you and I had a chat about the level of humor, didn't we, Matthew? Because I think you expressed concerns to me about it. And I remember I think it was with you, or maybe it was all three of us, I should say, specifically the defense that the humor should be a break from the tension of the book. It can't be the reason for the book.
Right.
And so having moments like that was great because, like you say, it adds to the character moment. And that kind of humor is it takes a step back from the they're going to kill each other and or have sex with each other, but that's still tension, and so kind of having that beat of pause really helps to kind of give the audience a bit of a break and a bit of a breather before they go back into the tension, because that is where the World of Darkness really works well. The humor should reinforce and reestablish the tension and darkness.
Yeah, the character that I was particularly intent on not being as funny as he could have been was Anatole of Clan
yes.
Malkavian, who
yes.
is in most of the Clan novels at some point or other, introduced, I think, in the Transylvania Chronicles with Lucita. And that's a personal issue of mine. I really struggle with funny Malkavians as concepts, not because it's impossible for a Malkavian to be comedic, but I think it's possible to read into that comedy that what you're saying is madness is hilarious because they're wacky.
Right.
And I really wanted our focal point Malkavian in this book to not be funny. Sometimes he's very bitter and dry, and I like that, but I didn't want him to be tripping over himself or talking to a stuffed bear or anything like that.
Yeah, that's always been my issue. Like, I played Malkavians for many, many years. That was always my, like, main clan. And I never played them funny. Like, I never played them silly or what, you know, people call fish malks, whatever.
Yeah.
And I've never liked that as a trope because it's too easy. And also because it feels kind of gross and kind of like you're making fun of people that actually have mental illness. So
yeah, a lot of people want to play Malkavians. This is an interesting tangent, really, because Malkavians are one of those almost... In retrospect, they're a problematic concept, mm-hmm. to put it plainly. And a lot of people play Malkavians as the Joker. Right. And it's quite an easy route to go down when playing a Malkavian. That, again, Agent of Chaos, who, yeah, I'm the only sane one in the room. I'm just driving all of you mad. It's, and you know, everyone loves the Joker as a villain because arguably he's the strongest comic book villain that's ever been written in sense of his iconic image and persona. But if every single Malkavian is like that, I think you've got a problem. And there's definitely been a past through my role-playing circles to see everyone who wants to play Malkavian being this, Joker type. Or the old archetypal knife secreted in a toy bunny, little girl Malkavian. And most of these stem from images. Mm-hmm. In the first clan book Malkavian.
Right.
Rather than written character concepts. Like the Fish Malk is, I believe, in the first clan book Malkavian.
Yeah.
And is a Malkavian holding a fish.
Yep.
I thought it was Dark Ages.
Now I may be incorrect.
What?
Is it Dark Ages?
I thought it was Dark Ages.
I don't remember where Fish Malk came from, but that became like the term for just a kind of ridiculous Malkavian character.
Right.
Ah, yes, yeah. Clan book Malkavian had Malk Content in. Sorry. That's one of the other fun concepts. Oh, Malkavian's got to love them, haven't you?
It's just weird, because like I said, I always played them. If you look at the derangements, there are very few that would actually cause you to act that way. There are lots of them on the list that are things like OCD and megalomania and stuff. And that's much more fun for me to play, personally. So that's what I always did. But actually, one thing I wanted to mention, just while we're kind of talking about other things for a second, is I love when we talk about some of these games and I hear how people pronounce a lot of the names. Because everybody's kind of got their own pronunciation. Well, no, just because I've spent years saying Sasha Vikos, and then to hear Matthew say, you know, Vikos over and over again, I'm kind of like, which one is right? I don't even know. And, you know, some of these names do have phonetic, you know, spellings in various books, but some of them don't, or some of them do. I haven't run across them. So it's always weird when you get to start talking about vampire with people
See how they say everything. I think in the, I think in the Vikos argument, you are undoubtedly correct. I've had to very much beat the anglicization of words out of my vocabulary as time has gone on, but I think it's definitely Sasha Vikos with the accent that you applied very subtly there. But you know, I think we may have discussed in the past. I know I've discussed with people recently the Bruja Bruja question, the Camarilla Camarilla, and Vitae Vitae. I know I mentioned this podcast, all kinds of nice pronunciation arguments, and of course Zimitsi, Zimisi, Shimisi, and so on. But that's for me part of the fun. It makes the World of Darkness and, by extension, Beckett's Jihad Diary a more exciting playground.
Oh, totally.
Because it implies that this is a world containing multiple cultures, vampires from multiple backgrounds, and why would a small town, white, male hell? Let's say Bible Belt of America, white male vampire. He receives a piece of paper that says Camarilla on it, or Camarilla. He's not going to pronounce it Camarilla, because why the hell would he? He's never spoken to someone who would pronounce it that way. He'll pronounce it phonetically.
See, whereas I pronounced it Camarilla for many years until my vampire players told me I was saying it wrong.
And the thing is, Rich Thomas has subsequently told me, no, it should be Camarilla. We decided on that.
Right.
So I've been pronouncing it wrong as well.
We all say it wrong. It's fine.
Yeah.
But that's one thing, actually, you're right. One thing it says about Masquerade specifically is it implies an oral tradition. A sect that, or just a species of vampires that generally have been trained writing things down is bad because look what happened to Bram Stoker's bullshit, and now suddenly we all got killed. So it does force kind of shift to kind of more of an oral tradition, and then naturally you're going to have regionalisms that come from that. So I have noticed that when talking with people about Vampire the Masquerade, a lot of how they pronounce words generally come from the other players they've run into in their region and how they pronounce them. So the players also end up with a bit of a regionalism. I just find that fascinating.
Hmm.
Yeah, no, I've definitely heard of, you know, cam games where they call it Camarilla, Camarilla, etc., and it very much is regional. Because, mm-hmm. we never, you know, released a book that was just a list of how to say everyone's name. Because that wouldn't be interesting. Who wants to read that? Except right. me, because I like being right.
And I feel bad because I don't have it anymore, but when we were looking at voice actors for the MMO, I was like, so who's gonna tell the voice actors how to pronounce these words? And they were like, we'll just find the book that has it. And I'm like, you're funny. We don't have that. So I had spent like weeks going through and determining it, and it was really a lot of listening to what Bloodlines did and what other people in the office said, and just making arbitrary decisions at certain points. Like, oh, we're gonna pronounce it this way for this game.
Yeah, so you were gonna be responsible for being the person who like codified how to say Zmiche.
Yeah,
and actually, or whatever.
And so I actually wrote that list, and it's sadly gone now. But I would exactly what you love to read, which is here's all their names, all spelled out, and the phonetic pronunciations, and how different languages. Because the other thing is also we had a lot of people from different countries working at the office, and so like one of the programmers lived in Moscow, and they, you know, obviously we had Scandinavian coworkers, and so I'd run also the words by them and say, how is it pronounced in your gaming group? And that was a fascinating conversation, because like how the Russians pronounced certain clans was really, really interesting. And then how the Icelanders pronounced certain clans was very distinctive and different. So it's a whole thing.
I think that's cool. I mean, that's interesting to me that it's, you know, it's obviously regional, but it's also by country and by how they apply their specific language rules to it. So yeah, that was just a really, I don't know, a weird linguistic tangent I wanted to go on for a second, because it's always interesting when I'm talking to the two of you and we're all saying the same word a different way.
Yes.
So, you know, it's just, it's cool to
again,
clarify.
People who have played Bloodlines, which is probably most people who listen to this podcast, will have heard Bruja being pronounced Bruja. Yeah. And I remember when I first played that video game, I was surprised that Bruja was in it rather than Bruja.
Yeah, same.
Because I thought, oh, this should be obvious, shouldn't it? But again, if you've got no frame of reference to think of it as Spanish origin, why wouldn't it be Bruja?
Mm-hmm. It does make sense. But also, yeah, it sounds wrong to me when I hear it, because I know the actual Spanish word Bruja, which means, you know, witch. So, yeah, I don't know. Very, very interesting. So, just to get back to Beckett before we wrap up, because we're getting close to an hour here. We talked kind of Easter eggs and stuff, but like, what was just both of you like your favorite part about working on this book, or favorite thing that you put in it, or favorite thing you got to revisit to put in it? Let Matthew go first this time, so Eddie can think about it.
Yay.
Yeah. Let Eddie go, make himself a meal, get some sleep, and then when he wakes up, it'll be his turn to talk. Maybe. I kind of half apologize. You know, I absolutely love Vampire the Masquerade. I don't think there's anyone who could doubt that. But I get very effusive when I talk about books like Beckett's Jihad Diary, because there's not one part of it that I dislike.
Mm-hmm.
I am incredibly proud of this book.
I dislike the title of chapter 4.
And what is the chapter of title? The chapter of title 4. There you go. I have lost my linguistic ability.
It's called The War Across Dixie.
That was not intentional, of course.
Oh, I know. Y'all didn't even know I was going to be editing it when you wrote it, so it's fine.
Well, maybe we did. but no, I'm very proud of it, the entirety of this book's contents. For me, as a writer, the most fun I had was probably writing the I guess, updates to the Giovanni Chronicles. Mm-hmm. My favourite clan, if I could ever be said to have one, the one I love to revisit, and if there's ever an opportunity on a book to write about them, I do, is Giovanni and Cappadocians, the various facets of the Clan of Death, because for whatever reason, that clan has always spoken to me as a player and a storyteller, and I think the Giovanni Chronicles was probably the first chronicle I ever played in, or mm-hmm. ran, I should say. So that's likely why they hold such a place in my heart, much the same as Neil and his Salubri fascination, which we sometimes mock, but I think everyone has a favourite part of the setting. So being able to do Giovanni Chronicles 5 chapter and the Many Faces of Death, but from a more sort of all-out insanity and great fun, I loved writing the Fall of the House chapter, mm-hmm. which is the Tremere focus, Tremere and Salubri, and then the Madness of Jerusalem, which, as already mentioned, it has a strong Malkavian focus, but it also leans into the Ashira. There's, again, a bit of Salubri, a bit of Bali, a bit of Talmahe Ra, I think, mm-hmm. are in there too. But I think the Madness of Jerusalem, for me, is the most complete chapter. It contains the greatest number of different elements that somehow coexist together, and for me is one of those chapters I like to point people at as evidence that whether your game is running at a street level or a high political level or a high metaphysical level, there is something in Vampire the Masquerade for everyone, because I think Jerusalem on its own is a fantastic city in which to set a chronicle, but that chapter really has a ton of chronicle hooks that you could latch a game onto and run for months and months.
Right. Yeah, no, I'm a big fan of that chapter. I was also a big fan of the Drowning of Rasputin chapter and the Transvaal Knights chapters. I think those had a lot of really cool information in them.
Just yeah. Oh, well, can I mention something about that?
Of course you can.
Very briefly. The Drowning of Rasputin chapter was a stretch goal that we managed to get following the Kickstarter, and is our South American chapter, and mm-hmm. contains probably of all of the chapters in the book the most new material, in the sense that there's lots of new characters, new concepts being thrown out there, and the general impetus behind it is this idea of drowned legacies. The indigenous vampires, potentially, if they are indeed vampires, of South America not waking up to drive out the evil colonials, although they certainly seem to be. The idea that they were always there, and unlike the way that, I guess, native vampires are often presented, are being beaten down with their indigenous communities, they just parasitically latched on to whoever the conquerors would be. And so they've survived and flourished quite happily and adopted the names Ravnos and Bruhar and Setite. And now, while the Sabbat is fracturing due to its new civil war, they're starting to reassert their dominance in their various domains. And just as a chapter full of teasers, it has so many introduction points for new bloodlines or new clans or a new aspect of the vampire mythos. And when I wrote that and developed it, I was very fortuitous to be able to consult with a number of friends of mine and former colleagues who live in and work in South and Central America, mm-hmm. and these colleagues are both are absolutely avid when it comes to the mythology, the gods, the goddesses, and so on of that part of the world. And there's so much there to till, and so many vampire myths as well.
Yeah.
So it was very easy to connect that up with the very scant teasers that existed in books like Diablerí Mexico and World of Darkness 2nd Edition to expand that into what you can see in that chapter. But it's a testament to the strength of how good a book can be if you consult with people who actually know the subject matter.
Right.
Because I would have never written it if I had just had to go on Wikipedia and pick a bunch of monsters out of a hat and say, hey, these are vampires now.
Yeah.
This was very much informed by people who knew the subject matter, and I think it stands up as a result.
Which is awesome, and a thing that I think we're trying to do across other game lines as well. I know we've been trying to do that for, like, Scion, for instance.
And yeah, definitely.
You know, going to people who actually know the subject matter, whether it's just as research or whether we're actually getting them to write it. There are a lot of, you know, sensitive topics, and the gaming industry has learned a lot even in the past 5 years, but certainly since, you know, the early 90s when some of these things started to come out. So I kind of like the fact that we're able to revisit them and update stuff for, you know, once again, for 2018. Eddie, did you have anything to say about the book in particular, or about that subject before we wrap up?
Mostly, Matt, as you touched on a little bit, is one of the things that I was happy to do with Beckett's, and I was happy to see in Beckett's, is that V20 as it conceptually was meant to be kind of preserved in amber. It's kind of, you could play any aspect of Vampire the Masquerade, you know, across the board.
Right.
But as we made the line, we realized that was not a sustainable path. That's one of the reasons why we had talked about doing a new edition, and White Wolf talked about doing a new edition, is that, you know, at a certain point in time, things have to start moving forward again. And so I was glad that we could do things like the Sabbat Civil War specifically, because that seems the natural endpoint to where that sect was heading. I mean, we've been teasing it off and on for years. I don't think it's intentionally. It's just more, if you start really digging into all the spot material, it's like, it's why are these guys not killing each other? And so that was just kind of like, let's have that happen. Let's have them dig into that, because it was a nice way to kind of give new life to the Sabbat concept. And I also thought that how the writers pitched that chapter in the book was really well, because it really, even though they were going through a civil war, even though they had some ideological and logistics problems, Beckett was still terrified of talking with them. And I think it really came across, the fact is that you don't hang out with these guys, you're not buddies with them. They're really scary, horrible people. And I think that really came across without losing Beckett's veneer of invulnerability that's important to his character. So it was a really good balance, and also a nice moment of showing that this is a living setting in the constraints we had for the 20th anniversary edition.
Awesome. Yeah. I can definitely see that. And especially when it comes to, like, Beckett, you know, there are moments of vulnerability in the book that I think just reinforce his attitude elsewhere. Because
so what about you, Dixie? What was your favorite part?
I was talking about my favorite chapters, where, like I said, I like the Drowning of Rasputin, which you then told me a whole bunch about, which was really cool. For me, I think a lot of reading Beckett, because I haven't been involved with reading Vampire Metaplot for a long time now, there was a lot of nostalgia in it for me, because I did, when I was, you know, 18, 19, 20, read a lot of the Clan novels, I read a lot more of the source books, and then I just didn't immerse myself in it for a long time until I started working for Onyx Path. And even then, I haven't done too much with Vampire, because most of the V20 stuff was kind of already in the works before I came on. So for me, like, this was... It was kind of cool. It was one of those books for me, like, very, very personally, that I kind of kept going, like, man, if 17-year-old me could see what I'm working on right now, they would be confused and excited. And then, you know, seeing all the characters that I remember from the various Clan novels, like we mentioned Lucita, and I say Anatole because that's how my Russian friend says that name. So seeing all those old characters, and then, you know, seeing all the little references of things like Bloodlines and various places. Lots of nostalgia in this book for me, but also a lot of new information. So I think that the entire writing team really captured that perfect blend of, you know, hey, here's stuff that you remember that you really, really like, and hey, here's stuff that we've updated for the modern era, and here's what's going on now. All in all, I really, really like this book. I think it's well-balanced, it's well-written, it was interesting. Like, sometimes when I'm editing, I do get a little bit bored, because it's like, okay, rules chapter again. But this one was really, really fun the whole way through. Like, it was interesting. When I got sent the additional chapters after the Kickstarter, I was like, ooh, more. You know, I got excited. So, it was a fun book all the way through. So we should probably start wrapping this up. Do you have any final thoughts, Matthew? Anything you want people to know?
Well, if there's anyone who's listening to this who hasn't read Beckett's Jihad Diary, I can admit that it will probably sound daunting to approach a book that recaps and expands on 20 plus years of meta plot. But the way the book is written is designed not just to appeal to people who already know that meta plot, but to people who want an entryway into it. People who want to get a scope of what the world of Darkness is about, not just one city or one particular clan's saga. So I very much recommend Beckett's Jihad Diary. There's so many uses for it, both as a storyteller tool for chronicle hooks, mm-hmm. of which some are called out in an out-of-character sense, while others are, of course, embedded in the text, but also as an artifact book. Even if you just buy the PDF, and I recommend the print copy because it's so beautiful to look at, but even if you just buy the PDF, in that sense, its utility is massive, because you can print out pages, cut out transcripts, emails, blog entries, newspaper clippings, scrapbook mm-hmm. entries, all of this stuff is within the book, and give them to your players as treasure pieces, you know, as things that their characters find. Set them on exploratory adventures where they try and find out more about the Kindred condition, and you can use Beckett's Jihad Diary as one big treasure chest, and I think that's one of its strongest suits. Mm-hmm. So as always, I'm always going to recommend this book, but if you do like it and you haven't already, please review it on DriveThruRPG. Mm-hmm. Please tell your friends. If you own a copy, post a photo of you holding it on one of the Vampire the Masquerade Facebook groups, because this is undoubtedly the peak of V20, and I think for a lot of people it's a favourite Vampire the Masquerade book. For me it is, that's for sure.
I like it a lot. I mean, our friend that we mention all the time, Jacob Burgess, calls it his book boyfriend. So, you know, people do love this book. He does. He brings it with him to his bloodline streams and holds it up and calls it his book boyfriend. So,
that's so cute.
Yeah. So just to give y'all an idea of how much some people do like this book, you don't have to like it as much as Jacob. I think he might sleep with it. But, you know, if you like it half as much as he does, you're doing really well. All right.
Yeah. So I have one question before we go.
Okay.
All of us came into this gig as fans of Vampire the Masquerade first.
Totally.
And I think I know the answers, but I'm curious about the reasons why. What is your favorite Vampire the Masquerade clan and why? I want to start with Dixie.
Oh, God.
Why would you ask this when we're trying to wrap up, Betty? Is this the worst?
Because I hate all of you.
The worst thing you could have possibly done.
I know.
And I'm super torn, because my favorite clan for years and years and years was Malkavian. Like, I played Malkavians. I love Malkavians. And as I've gotten older, it's kind of flipped over to La Sombra. Mm-hmm. And to me, which I think I've actually mentioned this before on the podcast, maybe. I don't know. To me, it's because La Sombra very much are kind of the classic vampires. I like the religious aspect to them. I also, like, Obtenebration is just cool.
It
like,
is.
I'm not going to lie. It is cool that the last time that I played La Sombra Antitrib, I could just stand in a corner and wave my hand and Shadow Tentacles murdered people for me. Like, right. That was fun. I also do really like Lucita of Aragon. You know, I've read her clan novels. I think she's an interesting character. You know, she's a princess, and she's also murders people with shadows. So,
like you do.
So yeah, no, I don't know. I've always liked, I'd say that's my favorite clan now. If you had asked me at the age of, 20, I would have said Malkavian. And I would have said because of the fact that they're connected to everything, and they tend to know more than people give them credit for, and that's, you know, they're fun to play very subtly for me.
That's very
cool. So now let Matthew talk forever.
Yeah, and it'll just fade out on my voice at the end. We won't have a proper sign off. And when we start the next podcast, it'll still be me talking.
Well, I was just going to say, how about we don't ask him the question, and we'll just take one of his Gentleman Gamer videos and just have the audio tacked onto the end of it for an hour and a half of talking about a certain vampire clan.
This will make me sound like a complete dick, but I'll say it anyway. I have never, other than those latest ones that I did for the World of Darkness channel, I've never rewatched those Gentleman Gamer videos. Can't stand watching myself It's the idea of it makes me cringe. I have no idea what I said in them. So if you decide to upload the audio from one, I will be forced to listen to it, and that will be a form of torture.
Ooh.
I mean, no, which leads me on to my favourite clan, the Daughters of Cacophony. No, not really. my favourite, oddly, and I say oddly because I'm always one of the quickest to slam my boot down on this clan, my favourite clan that I've played is Ravnos. My favourite character was a Ravnos.
Mm-hmm.
But my favourite clan as a concept obviously changes with the tides, and right now is the Followers of Set, but or the Ministry as they are in V5, and the reason is because I love the idea of them as the Clan of Faith. I really made a strong push in V20 Dark Ages and V20 to make them more the Clan of Faith than the Clan of Snakes or Clan of Serpents, and
right.
really harness their polytheistic background.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that they took on the snake-like trappings because of the Bible and the serpent in the Garden of Eden, and it being such a strong, iconic figure, despite the fact snakes have got nothing to do with Set outside of Conan the Barbarian.
Right.
The in the canon of Vampire the Masquerade now, the reason that they like snakes is nothing to do with Set. It is because the serpent in the Garden of Eden was such a symbol of counterculture, of mm-hmm. corruption, if you like. And the Edenites, which are introduced in Constantinople by Night, are just one arm of the Setites, of the Ministry.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the Witches of Echidna in the Hall of Jormungandr, and it just so happens that the followers of Set, the Orthodoxy, became prominent by the modern knights.
Mm-hmm.
And V5 sees them become more polytheistic, embracing different faiths, becoming more evangelical, more like the Protestants to the La Sombra Catholics.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that really speaks to a part of Vampire you don't often see, which is the drinking of someone's soul. Not in the form of diablerie, but the breaking down of their personality, their will, making them into your blood cultists, your slaves, and is innately Setite in background. So mm-hmm. for me, it is those darn dirty snakes.
It makes sense.
And you, Eddie?
For me, I like your guys' separation of clan I like to play versus clan I love. I enjoy playing Giovanni. I like the familial aspect specifically to it. Not so much the Italian stereotypes. I dislike that immensely. But the idea of we are a family both by vampire decree and also biologically, it's a nice dynamic that you don't see in other aspects of Vampire the Masquerade, and I enjoy digging into that. But my favorite clan will always be the Bruja. I personally identify with the struggle of anger at the world and environment around you. The catch-22 of the more you learn about the way things are, the harder it is to keep your crap together while looking at it. And just also the way that people look at you when you do kind of end up ranting at the inequities of the world and how people judge you by that perception. I very much feel a lot of that. I was a very angry young man growing up. Mm-hmm. Angry skater, deaf punk. I mean, it was very much kind of my wheelhouse. And so when I first read Vampire the Masquerade, that was the clan that just leapt out and grabbed me by the lapels and said, you have to play me. And there's other clans I really enjoy playing. I think I've played just about every clan at this point in time, and I love them all for various different reasons, but whenever it comes down to which is the one that you really love, it's going to always be the Bruja.
Right. And yeah, that's the thing, is that, like, you know, we ask these kind of questions, and it's like, well, what game am I playing in? What setting am I playing? What kind of character concept do I want? Because if I'm playing a Dark Ages game, I'm probably playing a Lianan. I'm a big fan of those. But you don't play them in modern games, so it's like, I don't know what to answer. But yeah, no, that's awesome. And honestly, that's something that I'm sure, like, we don't really talk about, like, what's your favorite clan, usually. So it's nice that we finally got that out of the way for listeners.
Yeah.
But yeah, you will definitely hear me. Or
ask
if you
again next week, we'll have different answers.
Yeah, exactly, right? We're going to change it every single week. That could also be the new running gag. Let's workshop that after after the podcast recording. All right, cool. Well, Eddie, where can people find you if they want to follow you on social media?
You can find me just about anywhere at Eddie Fate, EddyFate. My website is eddyfate.com. As I mentioned last time, I'm changing kind of how I do social media. So on Facebook, you can find my page, Eddie Web Writer. Eddie Fate will take you to that page. And my personal account, I'm kind of just keeping for personal stuff. But I'm planning to put more stuff on Eddie Fate Writer or anywhere. You can find me at pugstoday.com.
Awesome. And Matthew?
I am the Gentleman Gamer on YouTube, on the Onyx Path Forum, and Clack Click Bang on Twitter. You can find me all over the place.
Excellent. You can find me at Dixie Cyanide on forums, on Twitter, most places. I'm pretty easy to find. you can find us, obviously, at theonyxpath.com or the Onyx Path on Twitter. Actually, we're the Onyx Path pretty much everywhere. You can also find our podcast on iTunes, Google Play. Please rate and review us if you get a chance. Yeah, I'd like 5 stars. That'd be cool. And we will see you next week. As always, many worlds.
Bye-bye.
One Pathcast.